Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Deborah M. Pratt, author of the new book, The Tempting, Seducing the Nephilim. In addition to writing, my guest is an accomplished director, producer, and actress. In addition to books, she has written feature films for Warner Brothers and Sony, as well as for television series such as Magnum P.I., The Pretender, and Airwolf. Her first novel, Vision Quest, is science fiction for young adults. Welcome, Deborah. It's a pleasure having you in Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your fascinating background. You have an impressive resume, TV, film, masterpiece theater, and novels. Where did it all begin, and was it where you intended to go?
I think I've always enjoyed the art of art, performance. Right. And as a young age, I found that I had a kind of a unique voice. But I lived in Chicago, and all I really wanted to do was get away from the cold. The first time I came out to California, it was Christmas with my family, and it was freezing, snowing there, and it was 80 here. And I just said to my parents, leave me. So I said, I have to find a way back. But then at about 13, I started having this compassion to write. Mm-hmm. I wrote poetry. I started writing songs. Mm-hmm. And I really thought I was going to be a singer. So I got out here with, probably most people are too young to remember, a group called the Gold Diggers.
Hmm.
Yeah, Dean Martin, long time, when music was still on television.
Right.
It's back now, but it was a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a singer and a songwriter. And then I started looking at the roles for actors. I became an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And the roles for actors, especially women of color, were nil. So I started writing and found that when I was on a television show like Airwolf or Magnum, I could write an episode. And I went, wow, I can have a whole creative process behind this. And then I came up with a series called Quantum Leap, which did very, very well. And I really thought I was going to be able to explore my passion, which was science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that once you sell to a studio, it's theirs, not yours.
Right.
And so the Vision Quest, which came to me at about 21, about Earth's not too distant future, where we have banded together. We've joined as a human race. And we've started putting our genetics into plants and animals, mm-hmm. and we create alternate species. And then at the end of that, we start to put our genetics into machines, and those machines become sentient, and there's the conflict. So the story is told through the eyes of a young boy coming of age, and he is called to destiny, great, classic. Joseph Campbell, Call to Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, after writing so much science fiction, because you have to do intense research, and we can talk about that.
Right. I was going to ask you about the research.
I needed a break, so I started writing what I thought was going to be like fun chick lit book. And I guess I didn't have a boyfriend at the time, so it became this erotic, very sexual.
Okay.
I had the best sex I could imagine, and it was fun.
It was your writing.
It was my writing. So I wrote Age of Eve and then The Tempting, Seducing the Nephilim.
So Age of Eve, that was a novel that I didn't mention.
Oh, yes. Age of Eve is kind of a prequel to The Tempting.
Okay.
Same characters. And what you find out in the two books is that she's caught between parallel worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nephilim are controlling those worlds, but they need her, which is where the story unfolds, is for her discovering who the Nephilim are, who's this hot, amazing guy that she had one amazing night with. And then in The Tempting, in Seducing the Nephilim,
mm-hmm.
she wakes out of a coma and realizes that she had one event with this guy and got pregnant and wakes up with a child and him by her bed saying, marry me.
Uh-oh.
And she's going, what?
So explain Nephilim to us.
Okay, so I'm writing this book, and it's very sensual, and I'm going, okay, but this is great mystery. And so somebody said, oh, you should do vampires. And I went, no, vampires are done.
Right.
And they said, oh, well, what about a werewolf? I went, werewolves are done. So I'll start researching,
because
I love to research. And I came across the Nephilim, and I found them in the Bible, in the Quran, and in the Torah. So three major Western religions speak about their existence. And what's fascinating is there's kind of a two-pronged story. In one, in the biblical sense, they are the fallen sons of God. Okay. So God created first the Nephilim, and they were so out of control. They were like God's wild children, and so he banished them. And then he created the angels. Half of them got out of control, so he banished half of them. And then he created man and woman. By the way, there was the woman before Eve named Lilith, which I have got to work in that somewhere.
Right.
But she was a wild child, so she got banished off. And then he pulled from Adam a rib and created Eve to be, I guess, more subservient.
So these are the delinquents of God.
These are the delinquents of God, but they look back on earth and saw the women of men and went, ouch, gotta have some of that.
Ah.
And they love women's hair. That was the big thing that they just went, ow. And, so they came back. And they, in history, they started seducing women and having children. But here's the reality of the Nephilim. They were between 8 and 30 feet tall.
That's tall.
So I made them shapeshifters because how else would they have sex with women?
Right.
But if you think about it, if they were down here, the temples that were in Egypt that were built for a 30-foot person to walk through, it makes absolute sense.
That is interesting.
And then if you go on the internet and just type in Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M, there are actual pictures of 30-foot tall skeletons that they found. So they actually did exist as creatures, beings on this earth. I thought that was very cool.
That is fascinating.
So then the whole sensuality and sexuality aspect, and then the question as a writer, your favorite question, well, why? Why did they get banished? Why did they want to come back? And that's what you have to buy the book to find out.
Great. Perfect. And, you know, your books are said to break the mold of science fiction. Would you say that that's because you are taking from history and folklore, and or how do you break the mold of science fiction?
I think that's it. I think it's cross genres. Mm-hmm. So in The Vision Quest, it's science, it's fantasy, and it's spirituality. In The Age of Eve and Tempting, it's really about erotic storytelling, but it's more about empowerment. The idea that Eve, our lead character, has to find out who she is and has to go up against these essentially demons,
right,
I think is a very powerful message to women, you know, and the book goes into the power of sexuality, of why we as women are so repressed, especially in this country, but certainly around the world, because in Eve, the key to these other worlds is through our sexuality.
So it's not shy away from it. It's the opposite.
Embrace it. Embrace your power as a sexual being. We are sexual beings and we have great power. And I think that's why men repress it because they are so compelled and drawn to it. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to address that in a story to get people thinking. I think books are about getting people thinking.
And feeling.
And feeling. And looking at the world a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And fantasy is a great way because it's non-threatening.
Yeah, so you really combine fantasy, science fiction, and maybe a little bit of erotica.
And spirituality.
And spirituality.
Very much so, yes.
And would you say that Eve is a very strong woman?
In the beginning, she's not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a call to destiny.
Ah, so yeah, Campbell's journey again.
You find your strength in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not taught to dig deeper and realize that we're never given a challenge that we can't overcome. We just have to sit back and go, okay, how do I overcome this?
So it's got an optimistic message as well.
Very much so. And there she's got a best friend. She's got the man of her dreams who's wealthy, who's handsome, who has the house that she always wanted. But the history of the house and the history of the family becomes very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flashes from the parallel worlds as she starts to remember out of this coma. Mm-hmm. Where she came from, and then eventually where she really came from and where she's going.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, The Vision Quest, which is coming back out May 15th, the science was so detailed because I really wanted it based in the science that could be, the genetic splicing, the the technology. That took me about 5 years of research. And then to write the entire series of four books, it took me about another 5 years. So it's been 10 years on that journey. With Age of Eve and The Tempting, it took about a year and a half. Once I understood the to set up and research the world, and then the second book took about 8 months. It wrote much faster because, and it was one of those books. I don't know if you write like this, but this was one of those books where I sat down and I started writing. I had no idea where I was going, which is rare for me. I usually see the whole movie in
my head. You're a planner.
Yeah. And I started writing, and it was fun and kind of sexy and cute. And then suddenly this mystery happened, and I went, huh, what's that?
Like a trance where you don't know exactly how it got
there. I would
have
to get up and go back to the computer to write to go, well, what's going to happen next?
Right. It's channeling. You're channeling it.
So yeah. I
love those moments. Yeah. And it's hard to make them happen. But when they happen.
Wow. And it makes it a fun ride for the writer
because
you're excited to go sit at that computer. And, and you know, people always say, well, where do you get your ideas from? Sometimes they come from, you know, the universe, some event that happens to you that you just feel compelled to write. Sometimes they come from inspiration from someone you saw or something you saw that you feel must be told. And other times it's truly the muses. They just tap you on the shoulder and go,
Yeah, and I think of it as your subconscious mind speaking to you too.
I think there's a collective mind, which is in the Vision Quest as all. As well, in the sense that there's a universe of thought out there and they're trying to get through to us. And we creatives have to write it down. That's our job. We're messengers.
I love it. Great message. Now, the science part is nitty gritty. I mean, science is facts and you're not a scientist, or at least by trade. So how do you do your scientific research to get it right?
Well, it depends on the area. I usually will find an expert. I was looking in the Vision Quest, it's the future. So I had to invent what happens in the next 100 years or so. What happens with the earth shifting? I talked to geologists. And interestingly enough, from the time I wrote the first book, one of the things that I predicted in the book has already happened based on the tsunami in Japan, because I said there are a series of quakes and time starts over. So it's AQ after quake. And I said that the earth shifts 17 degrees off its axis. Well, the earthquake was so powerful that sent the tsunami to Japan and the one to, was it Thailand, to the Phuket Islands, was so powerful that it shifted the earth off its axis. So we're about 9 degrees off. And according to my book, we have 8 more to go.
Yeah. So you confer with geologists and geneticists and.
Right, right.
And they explain it in terms that you can really grasp.
Yeah, it's great. I have and then what I've done is I've started to gather them to what I call the greatest minds on the planet Earth. And I want to create a source for when the website is built that basically come on board, ask questions about the book, about the science of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to get Neil deGrasse.
Yes.
You know, on my board.
He would be fantastic.
I have a professor, Dr. Moglich, who's a nuclear physicist, because I said, where's power going to come from in the future? And we talked about, you know, methane. We're creating all this methane. Why not build conversions for it? And
absolutely.
You know, and then there's the internet, which I can get lost on, you know, because you think you're going in one direction. Then you go, oh, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And you go off on another direction.
As long as you don't get too diverted.
And when there were books,
yeah,
like encyclopedia and things like that, I could get lost in them too.
Well, let's look at your other writing. I know you've completed a screenplay for an epic, an historical love story called Chevalier and Antoinette. Tell us about that and when we can see it on the big screen.
Chevalier and Antoinette is based on the lives of a man named Chevalier de Saint-Georges, who in the 18th century was the finest swordsman of the age. Literally like gunfighters, people used to come to duel him in Paris. And he was a consummate musician. He influenced Mozart and Haydn.
Really?
He was tutor to Marie Antoinette. So he was a composer. And he was this virtuoso violinist that did things with a violin because he was a fencer. He would create these duels on the violin. And he was black. And I went, what? His father was a white nobleman who had a plantation in Guadeloupe. His mother was a beautiful slave. They had this child, and at five, he was a virtuoso violinist.
Fascinating.
So the father brings him to Paris to mm-hmm. educate him and to defend himself, because there was racism. He learned fencing, and he became the best in the Lavoisier School of Fencing. So he goes out to his concert, and he's performing, and he performs for Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI. And she sees him, and she's so moved and compelled by his music that she brings him into the court and has him tutor her. And this is historical. I mean, I went to Versailles, and I talked to the head of Versailles. They go, oh, oui, 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 we know Monsieur Chevalier. We have a night dedicated to his music. So he was an important person at the court. But then I realized that he was a fish out of water, being mm-hmm. a black man in 18th century France and powdered wigs and whatnot.
Right.
And she was a fish out of water because she was this Austrian queen that the French needed someone to hate, so they hated her.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two of them get together in this love affair that he realizes, you're the queen of France, I can't be with you. And because he rejects her, she destroys him. And meanwhile, ignores the fact that the French Revolution is coming up like a dragon on the sidelines.
Oh, what a wonderful story.
So it's a great story. It's how he saves her, and in the end, how she saves him.
It's interesting that we haven't heard of him, or at least I haven't.
There's some incredible black contributors to Western culture, like Alexandre Dumas. People don't realize that he was part mm-hmm. black. And Pushkin from Russia was the son of an African. So there's a lot of contributions, mm-hmm. and that's what I was looking for, something that showed how influential, black people just didn't kind of appear in slavery and then
right.
in the 50s. It's
right.
just there was great history that goes back, mm-hmm. and then there's some amazing stories. If you as a writer really want to look at the Moors, who conquered the world at one point.
I'm descended from that.
Wow.
So when is this going to become a movie?
Well, there's always the good question. It's hard in the sense that it's a black lead. Terrence Howard read it, who's on Empire.
Mm-hmm.
loved it. It's finding the backing to do it. I've been to France. The French are gaga over it. They want to do it. I've gone to Romania and Budapest and the Czech Republic and looked at, because it's very expensive to shoot in Paris. When the time is right, I'll put it together. I thought I had it together about a year ago, and it didn't get together.
So I hear that that's the most challenging part of making a film, that you can, looking for the funding, and then even when you get it, it falls through, and that there's no real order to the way things
and it
go.
Almost doesn't matter who you are. It certainly helps if you're Steven Spielberg, but I've heard him tell the same story.
Really?
Yeah. You know, he's marketable in a whole other way, and that's why the one thing that I can do is write, and that's what I love about writing a book. I don't need anybody to tell me what to do. I don't need anybody's permission to sit down and write it. I can just write the book and give it to the reader. I want to do more. I want to come back to the San Diego area, and hopefully you guys will give me some more airtime.
Airtime. Well, let's talk about your feature film called Heart Swear, which will star Taraji P. Henson from the hit show Empire as well. And she's playing an attorney defending a friend for the murder of her abusive husband. Another fascinating topic, quite different. How did you become involved with that one?
I was at American Film Institute, mm-hmm. and I directed a short film that I wrote called Girlfriends, and it was about two little girls, one black, one white, in the South, and they were best friends, and they had a great time, and they ran through the countryside, and they truly loved each other, and then they had to deal with the real world, who didn't want them to be friends because of mm-hmm. their color. Meanwhile, the young white girl had a storyline that her father was abusive to her. And he had beat her. And then the young black girl she stood up to one of the kind of the town matriarchs. And it angered her so much so that they set people out and they attacked her uncle and it got out of hand and they hanged him.
Wow.
And so they shipped the black girl off and the black girl said to her friend, you witnessed this too. You gotta come with me. And the black girl says, the white girl says, I can't leave. Nadine goes, I can't leave. Nadine says, but you know what? If I ever need you, you have to come back. And the black girl said, someday I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm going to stop your father from hurting you. And so they make a heart swear, which is kind of a promise, mm-hmm. like a pinky promise. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's maybe 15 years later, 20 years later, she's gone from an abusive father to an abusive husband. Mm-hmm. He happens to be the next lieutenant governor, but he beats her severely. And one night, he beats her so severely that she kills him, but she doesn't remember killing him. So she's on trial for the murder. It becomes a whole event because mm-hmm. of who he was, because of who she is, and because they need to put her on trial, mm-hmm. which is going to be a very public trial. And my research on that to show how many women defending themselves end up in prison when the man walks away after all that he's done, yes. including like killing their children. And
yes. I've seen that a lot as a social worker.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to capture that reality and tell a story. So it's a few good men. I did my best Aaron Sorkin. Mm-hmm.
So where is that film along the process?
We are in talks with Screen Gems. Mm-hmm. Taraji has signed on
Great.
With us. I'm waiting for all the paperwork.
So that's going to be a reality soon.
Soon. Well, we were hoping to be shooting, be in pre-production in May, shooting in June. Her show got picked up, Empire. Yo, Empire, go cookie. So I don't know what the time frame is going to be. Mm-hmm. We just have to work it now with her schedule.
So we'll look out for Heart Swear.
Please do.
And we haven't talked much about your directing or your producing. And you know, I can't help thinking, as a writer, I can't help thinking that I've directed stage plays, that the directing is a little bit like directing characters when you're writing a story.
Very much.
Do you enjoy them, would you say, at the same level? Do you apply one skill to the other? How do they compare for you?
Well, as a director-writer, you understand that you see the play mm-hmm. as you write it. You know where each character is in time and space as you tell the story, because you have to. So the better you are at directing, the better you are at writing. The better you are at editing, the better you are at writing. The better you are at understanding music. I was a singer first, remember? Mm-hmm. So I've been in recording studios. So when I finish shooting, you know, and a film is stillborn, Spielberg said, until you put sound and music to it. So I have a great ear to bring in sound effects and bring mm-hmm. out sound effects, and when to just go with music or when to just go with sound effects, and when the vocals aren't right, you know, as people speak to each other, mm-hmm. I have a good ear for that. As a director, you have to be able to do all those things. Once it's on the page, but it has to be on the page first. Mm-hmm. So you put everything on the page. You put all your characters, mm-hmm. you put all your locations, you put all your transitions, you put mm-hmm. all your story out there. And then as a director, it's like lifting up the book into a screen and or lifting up the script into a screen.
You get to see it.
And you get to see it. But the more understanding you have of those other arts, I think the better you are as a writer, the better you are as a director, the better you are as an editor.
They're all connected.
They're all connected.
Now, what about the solitary aspect? When do you write? You know, the sitting down, the grind of it.
I can clean a house better than anyone I know when I'm not ready to sit down and write. You know, it's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, and avoid it.
I can avoid it. But if I'm into it, especially if I have a deadline, mm-hmm. do you work better with deadlines?
I work better without deadlines. I don't do it.
Even if I do a self-imposed deadline, mm-hmm. I gotta finish this by, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. So if I have a deadline, I will carve out time. And I say this to new writers all the time. Mm-hmm. People go, well, how do you write? How do you get? I say, pick a time that's your time and literally start out with 5 or 10 minutes. But you have a place with your computer, you have everything, you turn off the phone, you close the door. No one can come in for 10 minutes. Write for 10 minutes, write anything. Just put the idea, hi, my name is mm-hmm. DM Pratt. mm-hmm. And then at the end of 10 minutes, walk away and let your mind start to work and do your dream work. Come back, same time, same place. Work for 10 minutes more, building on what you wrote, rewriting it, polishing it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then in a week, if you can wait that long, extend it to 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And you'll find that at the end of a month of learning how to isolate yourself, you can build on it. So I can sit down and I can write for 6 hours. Now I have to get up and walk around because your body just goes, ugh!
Yeah.
The isolation, and there's some people that work this way on certain projects, I guess I do. I don't know if you do. Where you just have to say it out loud. You've got to tell the story. You've mm-hmm. got to make sure that it's clear in your head mm-hmm. before you write it down. So
do you read at book signings? You read from your work?
I have, yes. But I've also, in Chicago, as a matter of fact, they do a thing where you can come in and bring a chapter and, or tell the story of the chapter in front mm-hmm. of an audience. So you can mm-hmm. see, you can tell if it's on its feet, whether it works or not.
Right, right.
And the same thing with a script. If you have a group of actors, you get together, you hand out the script, and you do a reading, which is great for casting because you'll see where an actress or an actor gets stuck. There's no transition in the monologue that you've
right.
written.
Right.
So you go back.
Yeah.
And rewrite is the art of writing. Was that Mario Puzo that said
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you have another book in you about giving back to other writers or helping new writers.
Oh, I haven't thought about that.
Mm,
yeah. I speak on it. But
some good advice there.
Thank you.
Well, Deborah, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it was wonderful talking to you. For more information on Deborah M. Pratt, or DM Pratt, and her work, please visit her website at deborahmpratt.com.
That's the biblical spelling, DeborahMPratt.
Okay, thank you for letting us know. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Thank you, Raina.